This is an ABC podcast.
Welcome to AM. Good morning. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, U-turn. The federal government changes direction on the NBN. An Australian scientist warned the damage the coronavirus does to the brain may also lead to conditions like Parkinson's disease.
I think we're still discovering the full implications of this. Obviously, there's some very serious short-term dangers, but what is really emerging is that there are some really serious long-term dangers as well. And in terms of how we manage this going forward, then we need to be cognizant of those dangers.
Only weeks ago, the British Prime Minister was urging Brits to get out and back to the office. Now he's had to change course and tell people to work from home if they can in an attempt to control a second wave of COVID-19. Boris Johnson says the UK is at a perilous turning point and he's given a primetime TV address to try and persuade everyone to accept a reduction in freedoms for another 6 months. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
The virus has started to spread again in an exponential way.
It was the third nationally televised address by the Prime Minister since the start of the pandemic, on the back of the grim news from scientists that in the UK there could be 50,000 new cases of the virus per day by the middle of next month. Prime Minister Johnson is putting the onus back on the people.
Now is the time for us all to summon the discipline and the resolve and the spirit of togetherness that will carry us through.
The message, follow the new rules or more freedoms will go.
The tragic reality of having COVID is that your mild cough can be someone else's death knell.
Just as the campaign to get people back on the tube and back to the office was gearing up, it's been stopped in its tracks. Now they're being told to work from home again if they can. And just weeks after a successful campaign to get people to eat out, the hospitality sector has been slapped with a 10 p.m. curfew. Boris Johnson announced the new national restrictions in the House of Commons after an emergency meeting at Downing Street.
I'm sorry to say that as in Spain and France and many other countries, we've reached a perilous turning point.
He says the number of coronavirus cases has quadrupled over the past month. So there'll be an extension to where masks need to be worn and heftier fines for those who don't comply with the new rules. Spectators coming back to sports will be delayed and less people can attend a wedding. And the restrictions won't be short-lived.
Unless we palpably make progress, we should assume that the restrictions I have announced will remain in place for perhaps 6 months.
Boris Johnson says it's all about ensuring there's no second lockdown and bringing the R, or reproduction rate, down to one. If it doesn't work, stricter measures will come.
I think probably just closing the bars at 10 ultimately won't go far enough and they'll probably need to do a bit more.
So I don't think it'll make a big difference, to be honest. So probably within a couple of weeks I'll have to announce something a bit more stringent.
The UK is a few weeks behind continental Europe in terms of infections and nothing's going well there. Spain, the Czech Republic and France have infection rates well above 100 per 100,000 people. The Spanish army has been brought in to enforce a lockdown in parts of Madrid. This is a joke, this man says. The neighbourhood next to mine is not confined, but mine is. It is a joke. Boris Johnson says the military could be used to help police enforce the rules in the UK too. This is Samantha Hawley in London reporting for AM.
In the United States, the coronavirus death toll has passed 200,000 with an average of 850 people still dying every day. America leads the world with the number of confirmed cases and deaths as the president continues to downplay its seriousness. North America correspondent Catherine Diss reports the bleak milestone comes as the political manoeuvring continues over filling the vacancy on the Supreme Court.
Thousands of American flags have been planted on the National Mall in the Capitol to honour the lives lost to the coronavirus.
And these flags are indicative not only of the lives lost, but of the families left behind and suffering.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi toured the memorial to remember the dead and their families. But like much in this country, it became political.
But this was preventable. Not all of it, but much of it. And what could be lost in the future is preventable too, if we embrace science.
Even as the grim milestone of 200,000 deaths approached, the US President Donald Trump continued to downplay its seriousness at a campaign rally last night.
In some states, thousands of people, nobody young, below the age of 18, like nobody. They have a strong immune system. Who knows? You look, you take your hat off to the young because they have a hell of an immune system, but it affects virtually nobody. It's an amazing thing.
It comes as a bitter political row continues to distract attention away from the deadly crisis to the nation's next Supreme Court justice. 2012 presidential nominee Mitt Romney has been closely watched as a possible deflector. He's one of a few Republicans to publicly criticise the president, including voting to remove him from office during February's impeachment trial. But on the next Supreme Court appointment, he's behind Donald Trump.
I came down to the side of the Constitution and precedent as I've studied it and make the decision on that basis.
The senator from Utah says historical precedent supports filling the seat in an election year when the presidency and Senate are controlled by the same party. His decision more or less paves the way for a vote in the Senate this year. Democrats are crying foul, accusing Republicans of hypocrisy for blocking an appointee put forward by Barack Obama in February 2016 because it was within an election year. Here's Democratic Senator and Minority Leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer.
They all made one argument for a year, an argument they insisted was a principle when it was good for them politically, and now they're doing the opposite thing.
But the Democrats have little power to stop the nomination from proceeding. The president plans to announce his appointment on the weekend. This is Catherine Deese in Washington, reporting for AM.
The National Broadband Network's about to get a major fibre upgrade to provide better speeds to homes and businesses in the latest response to the COVID-19 crisis. It's interesting because the boost follows years and years of criticism that the project's rollout was substandard because of the Coalition's decision to use copper wire and old technologies instead of fibre connections. So, is this announcement today from the Morrison government a backdown or an admission that the NBN's not good enough? For more, I was joined a short time ago by our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. Peter, this project has been dogged by political acrimony for so many years. How significant is this announcement?
Well, good morning, Sabra. This is very significant given the complaints about the NBN and the hot political debate over so many years. Of course, the initial plan announced by Labor under Prime Minister Kevin Rudd was to deliver fibre to the home for 93% of premises and fixed wireless for the rest. But in 2013, when the Coalition was elected under Tony Abbott, that was changed to a multi-technology mix that instead provided fibre to the node for most homes and businesses. That means old copper wire making up the last kilometre or so. Later, a halfway house of fibre to the curb was introduced when the NBN became under intense political pressure and business heat a few years ago. Now, at a time when major investment is needed to deal with the COVID crisis, the NBN Co will spend $4.5 billion upgrading the network to increase speed for up to 75% of fixed line premises, something that could create 25,000 jobs. We'll probably hear more about that in the October 6 budget. The Communications Minister, Paul Fletcher, will announce this today. He was on the road this morning and not available to speak with AM, but this does coincide with the NBN Co's latest corporate plan to be announced later today.
Given all of that, Pete, is this a major admission from the NBN Co and the Federal Minister, Paul Fletcher, that the NBN isn't fit for purpose?
Well, it's certainly not being spun that way, but it is a change in political direction given the constant defence of the NBN from Paul Fletcher and the former Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull that the lower tech strategy was the way to go. But Mr Fletcher will say today that the government always intended to upgrade the NBN when the demand or the need for speed was there. That demand, of course, has now come from the COVID-19 crisis, with many Australians working from home, doing doing video conferences, exchanging massive files. So there's not only a demand, but an expectation now that the NBN will be able to cope. Just yesterday, Paul Fletcher announced a $700 million plan to help business get better connected to fibre NBN. At a time of crisis, as the federal budget approaches, there is also important here because, according to the Finance Minister, Matthias Cormann, the upgrade will add $6.4 billion to economic growth each year by 2024. Now, not surprisingly, the NBN has provoked intense criticism over the years, but this morning the upgrade has been cautiously welcomed, including from one of the NBN's most vocal critics, the independent telco analyst Paul Buddha.
This is an excellent first step in the right direction. It's a total reverse of the policy of the government that, it first indicated that there was no need for fiber optic, that there was no demand for it and they didn't want to do it. And obviously, this is a reversal of that policy, which is a good thing. The next step, of course, is then, what is the national plan? Where are we going from here? The whole plan of the NBN was to give nationwide access to good quality broadband. At the moment, at least a quarter of the population is on poor broadband and, the network needs to be upgraded.
Peter, given we've had the best part of a decade of political combat over this and now this upgrade, how has Federal Labor responded?
Well, Sabra, for Labor, this is a back-to-the-future moment, even though we are in changing times. But Kevin Rudd has been out on social media saying that it's a mega backflip and a total policy fraud. The Shadow Minister for Communications, Michelle Rowland, says the flaws in the Coalition's NBN plan have now been exposed by the move to upgrade the network, showing that it wasn't good enough in the first place.
Worse than that, this is the most extraordinary, humiliating, expensive, wasteful public policy backflip in a generation. This is a government who, for the last 10 years, have been denying the need for a world-class NBN, instead saying they could do it cheaper, that they could do it faster, that it would be more affordable. It's been none of those things. On every big call, this government gets it wrong.
That's the Federal Shadow Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, and before her, our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan. There's still a lot about COVID-19 that we don't know. For example, whether it might trigger some long-term neurological consequences. After the Spanish flu pandemic in 1918, there was a big spike in Parkinson's cases, and Australian health experts fear that history might be about to repeat. Penny Timms from the Specialist Reporting Team has more.
Melbourne woman Sheena Petrell was just 47 when she was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease.
Well, initially I had difficulty with walking with my left side, so I found that I was limping and I put a lot of pressure on the ball of my foot. It wouldn't necessarily stop me doing things, but I couldn't do it as well.
Now, scientists are investigating whether there may be a looming increased risk of Parkinson's disease caused by COVID-19 triggering an inflammation response in the brain, spinal cord and nerves. If that's the case, Sheena Petrell says early diagnosis will be key.
For people who have tremors and more difficulties with their movement, I think earlier detection and getting onto treatment early would be much better in the long run.
Professor Kevin Barnum is from the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health in Melbourne. His team is investigating the potential link, and those concerns are outlined in a paper published in today's Journal of Parkinson's Disease.
Parkinson's disease, a very specific part of the brain degenerates. There are a number of different causes. One of the causes is inflammation. And the virus, I think most of us are aware, helps to drive inflammation. Once the inflammation gets into the brain, it starts a cascade of events which can ultimately lead to Parkinson's.
COVID-19 and Parkinson's already share some similar symptoms.
Loss of smell is actually one of the first symptoms of Parkinson's disease. Now, whether the mechanisms are the same, again, that remains to be determined. But certainly the loss of smell is a common symptom in both diseases.
While there's no established link between Parkinson's and COVID-19, researchers point out that 5 years after the Spanish flu, there was a 2 to 3-fold increase in Parkinson's disease. Associate Professor Lindsay Collins-Prano is the head of the Cognition Ageing Laboratory at the University of Adelaide. And while not involved in this study, she agrees a link may exist.
If we knew who was at risk of developing it early, before that brain cell loss becomes catastrophic, it gives us a potential opportunity to intervene to stop the death of those brain cells and to try to protect them.
Even if a connection is proven, it doesn't mean everybody who gets COVID-19 risks developing Parkinson's. But Professor Kevin Barnum says it's important to be alert.
From my perspective, I think what we need to be with COVID-19 is very careful. I mean, I think we're still discovering the full implications of this. Obviously, there's some very serious short-term dangers, but what is really emerging is that there are some really serious long-term dangers as well. And in terms of how we manage this going forward, then we need to be cognizant of those dangers.
That's Professor Kevin Barnum from the Florey Institute of Neuroscience and Mental Health in Melbourne, ending that report from Penny Timms. Over the past week, we've heard a lot about plans to reduce carbon emissions through boosting technology. One small element of that involves lowering the cost of carbon farming. That's the process of capturing and holding carbon in vegetation and soils through planting and better management of livestock, fertiliser and fire. Annie Guest reports.
Agribusinessman Matthew Warnken helped establish the world's first soil carbon farm to receive government carbon credits. It's near Warragul in Victoria.
At its essence, it's about changing farm practices to take carbon out of the atmosphere, where it's a problem, and put it into the soil, where it's an actual asset.
It's needed because cropping and grazing depletes about half the soil's carbon, and carbon helps soil hold water and boosts nutrient and biological activity. To replace that soil carbon, growing and leaving plant roots in the ground is important. Matthew Warnken says the Warragul farm grows deep-rooted radishes along with peas, corn, rye, oats and grasses.
A diverse mix, almost a buffet salad bowl of forage species for cattle to graze. They graze it off, the roots die, and those decomposing roots add to the organic matter, that organic carbon within the soil.
In return, the farm's owners receive $50 to $100 per hectare in carbon credits. The government says such projects have the potential to help lower Australia's annual emissions by about 17%, but measuring soil carbon is expensive. It's now one of 5 priority areas under the government's technology roadmap, aiming to find ways to lower measurement costs.
So that reduces the barrier to entry for people who want to engage in storing soil carbon.
That's Professor Mark Howden, a director of the Climate Change Institute at ANU. He supports soil carbon farming, but he says it's only of relatively small benefit when it comes to mitigating climate change.
Climate change is essentially the icing of the cake. The real benefit from increased soil carbon is from all those sustainability agenda issues, such as increased productivity, increased sustainability.
So 530 million tonnes a year of carbon dioxide is what Australia emits. So how much carbon emissions do these carbon farming measures take out?
Well, it's a matter for some discussion because there's a lot of uncertainty, but it's actually a very small number.
While the federal government says it expects to reach net zero emissions in the second half of the century, Professor Howden says the most certain path to achieving that would be a carbon trading scheme.
Annie Guest reporting there. In the far west of New South Wales, there's a bunch of people who can't wait for South Australia to reopen its border at midnight. The border closure has been a huge inconvenience to people in the outback mining town of Broken Hill and those in outlying sheep stations, stopping them from getting to a medical appointments and visiting their children at boarding school. Gavin Coote reports.
Jennifer Seymour hasn't been able to watch her children play sport or see family in Adelaide for 6 months. She lives on a station in far west New South Wales, about 100 kilometres east of the South Australian border.
The scariness for us was if something happens to someone. Adelaide's our nearest medical facility, major facility. My husband had an accident 2 years ago and fractured his skull and face, and this is where he would have been flown. And if we'd have been on the other side of the border, we wouldn't have been able to see him.
South Australia will lift its COVID-19 border restrictions with New South Wales from midnight tonight. It's a huge relief for Jennifer Seema, who has two children at boarding school in Adelaide.
When they came close, I panicked, I suppose, a little bit and decided to bring our children home early from school as I didn't want them to close and not be able to get them. So now we've quarantined all up for just under a month, 28 days, to get the children back to school for terms 2 and 3. So the border closures, just family, there's so many with family and connections in Adelaide. The families are all very close. The kids are friends with kids from, you know, the age of 5 till the age of 25. Everyone's friends. It's just how it works where we are.
The nearest major centre is the New South Wales mining town of Broken Hill, where many of its 20,000 residents have strong ties with South Australia. Jennifer Seema knows plenty of locals who won't waste any time crossing the border as soon as it opens.
Broken Hill feels like it's Adelaide, and there's so many people we know have got one foot in the car, I think. Just the angst of not seeing family. We know of so many people that have put off medical appointments because they can't afford to isolate for 2 weeks. They've attempted to get exemptions. It really worries me that things that have been just put off regards to, say, cancer diagnoses and all those other things. You know, we know of people that have been diagnosed but aren't willing to go to Sydney to get follow-up tests because they're too scared to. They don't know Sydney. It's such a foreign entity, and have just been waiting for this border to open so they can come to Adelaide and get these tests and go and see their own specialists. I think the medical side has been the most terrifying for people from Broken Hill.
Is there the feeling that this could be a temporary reopening, or is everyone feeling pretty confident that this will be permanent now?
In my opinion, I'm really terrified. It's just a temporary thing that as soon as there's any small spike that they'll overreact and close it again. All Broken Hill's ever asked is to be included in that South Australian border, like to move it just over that South Australian side. You know, I don't think anyone's too worried about the rest of New South Wales at the moment. It's just we rely so much on South Australia for everything, so much. No one really goes to Sydney or East even. This is where we go, here or Mildura, and we'll cut off from both at one stage.
That's Outback New South Wales mother Jennifer Seema ending Gavin Coote's report. The border restrictions have sparked a staycation boom in Outback Queensland. You might remember the report we brought you earlier this week about that. Other rural and regional areas are experiencing a big increase too, but economists warn the recent surge could be a sugar hit rather than a long-term trend. Here's National Regional Affairs reporter Lucy Barber.
In parts of Australia, tourism is booming because people have been forced to scrap their international winter getaways. They've swapped the Autobahn for Outback Highways and the Amalfi Coast for WA's Ancient Canyons.
I just really was so desperate to get out of the city and, yeah, explore a bit more of the state while we have the opportunity.
25-year-old Hannah Doherty from Perth was meant to be holidaying in Europe. After cancelling her trip, she hit the road to Exmouth and Carrageenie, the state's second largest national park, in the Pilbara instead.
It was incredible. Yeah, everyone's doing the same thing, I think. Just never got round to it because we were travelling internationally.
International travellers injected $30 billion into the Australian economy last year, so the sudden surge in domestic tourism has been a big boost for tourist hotspots. The Regional Australia Institute's chief economist is Kim Horton.
We know that we have about 11 million Aussies going overseas each year, so if some of those are redirected towards domestic tourism, there's certainly a possibility to fill the gap.
But he and other economists, like Terry Rawnsley from SGS Economics, doubt the recent spike is a long-term trend.
And also if their tourism offers quite sort of narrow, whether it was focused on, you know, that backpacker market or even, you know, high-end tourists, kind of like a little bit like Byron Bay, those areas will struggle a bit more to find domestic tourists to replace their international customers they've lost.
Tasmanian tourism operator Greg Price is caught up in that predicament. He sells packaged bus tours to backpackers keen to explore Tasmania's national parks and wildlife. In a good year, he'd have 2,000 guests heading out on trips, but he hasn't run a tour since March.
The international guests tend to stay a lot longer, so they come to Tasmania and they're thinking about staying for 7 to 10 days, whereas locals or even interstate visitors, they're just thinking a weekend or a long weekend. And international visitors spend the most followed by interstate visitors, and then interstate visitors don't spend as much per day.
He's worried that without cashed-up international visitors, the future of his industry and the flow-on effects for regional communities could be dire.
I mean, I've just had last week, one of my last staff has handed in his notice because he's going to work somewhere else and cited uncertainty in tourism.
That's adventure tourism operator Greg Price ending Lucy Barber's report there. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Chris Dengate.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Australian universities are shrinking. Their budgets, their student intake, their staff, everything but the buildings. So how bad is it?
Today on The Signal, the damage so far to Australia's university sector and what that might do to the country as a whole in the long run. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.